There's a little ditty. Maybe some of you have heard it. Same song, fourth verse. Could be better, but it's going to be worse. That's pretty much the story of Job, at least in the heart of the book, where you keep hoping that maybe one of these chapters, someone's going to finally bring something encouraging, specifically Job's friends who sort of show up as comforters, and we sort of put that in, you know, quotation marks, because they seem to do a consistently lousy job of bringing any sort of comfort, but instead we just keep finding it just keeps going from bad to worse. And in case you are just visiting with us this morning or new, kind of the plot line of Job goes something along these lines, that there is a contest proposed in heaven between God and Satan that revolves around the life of a man named Job. And the contest specifically is proposed by Satan, and it goes like this. God, if you would strip away or allow everything in this man's life to be taken away, I don't think he would hope in you anymore. And that's sort of what the whole book revolves around. Would a man who trusts and hopes in the Lord continue that if everything was lost? So quickly through the first couple chapters, we see that's exactly what plays out. Job's life is literally destroyed before our very eyes, family, health, everything taken, and yet stubbornly he clings to a hope in the Lord against seeming all odds. That's what's pretty amazing, and never miss how amazing Job's faith is when everything is taken. Along the way, three friends show up, and they come to comfort Job. And that's what really the heart of the book's about, is the conversation between these three friends and Job. And so the way it works is the first friend will speak, Job will respond, the second friend speaks, Job responds, and so on and so forth. They go through three cycles of that. And so by the time we're in Job chapter 15, we're in the second cycle, first friend. So we've heard Eliphaz the Temanite speak before. He was the very first one to speak. He showed up, and there was at least a hint of sympathy when he first spoke. And now by this point, that sympathy will be pretty much gone by the time he's now speaking to Job. But before we dive into that specific passage, I think we just should ask this question that is beautifully answered by a man by the name of Christopher Ash. And here's the question that I think is important for us to ask right about now. Why is the book so long? I mean, you go to the New Testament and there's some profound, rich theology packed into, you know, four or five chapters in many, many New Testament books. And now we come to Job, where it just seems like page after page, not often feeling radically new or different than the last page. So why? And here's an answer. To grapple deeply with God in a messed up world takes time. We cannot tidily sum up the message of Job in a postcard or tweet. We need to let these truths soak into our soul and engage with us in our real human experience, and there is no shortcut for that. Beware of the desire to summarize it, rush it, get through it quickly so we can get to the next thing, or to boil it down to tidy propositions. So we're doing our best to honor that, because you know as well as I do that grappling with the mess of life is not a week-long project. It's not even a month-long thing. When you hit those kind of moments, like what Job of a very, very messy world. So let's get back to work in chapter 15 and see where the story takes us this morning. I'm going to read just the first 14 or 15 verses. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, so just a reminder, Job's just spoken. Now Eliphaz says, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he argue in unprofitable talk or in words with which he can do no good? But you are doing away with the fear of God and hindering meditation before God. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, not I. Your lips testify against you. Are you the first man who was born? Were you brought forth before the hills? Have you listened in the counsel of God? And do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we don't know? What do you understand that is not clear to us? Both the gray-haired and the ages are among us, older than your father. Are the comforts of God too small for you, or the word that deals gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away? Why do your eyes flash, that you turn your spirit against God and bring such words out of your mouth? What is man that he can be pure, Or who is born of a woman that he can be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones. The heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks injustice like water. And I could add this little statement just so we all get what he's talking about. And Job, you are that man. Get it? Eliphaz shows up, says, Job, everything that's coming out of your mouth is an attack on a system that we all believe in, all hold dear, all understand to be important, all believe to be at the core and center of the world that God has made. And the system works so simply, Job, that we just are shocked that you cannot understand it. God is all powerful and he is good. And therefore, the world is ordered morally and it is just. Therefore, the good get rewarded, the bad get punished. And if you are suffering, you must be bad. If you're blessed, you must be good. And Job, it's just that easy. And yet Job constantly, continuously through the whole book will say, it just can't be that way. And so Eliphaz arrives on the scene yet again in his second speech to remind Job that he is dead wrong. Now that's kind of the summary of what he's just said in those verses. You see it so clearly in that last verse that I read to you. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks injustice like water. It's not just that Job does bad things on special days. He's basically saying, Job, you just all the time, you can't stop being an unjust, evil man in the sight of God. It's just who you are, Job. And it's almost like Eliphaz is wanting to say, the quicker you recognize it and repent and come back to God, the better off it will be. He doesn't quite get to those words, but he has before. That's where he's gone up until this point. Job, just admit that you are in the wrong and you'll get all the stuff back. But you remember consistently Job's response. I don't care about the stuff. I care about God. How do we find our way back to God is going to be Job's consistent target. That's his mission. Now, through those verses I read, Eliphaz basically makes at least five fairly clear arguments or points of why he thinks Job is wrong. Let me just quickly sketch them out for you. The first one comes in verse 2 or 3 where he's going to claim that Job's words are vain or empty or meaningless. In other words, Eliphaz is saying, Job, I've listened to everything you said. I've considered it all. And it doesn't make any sense. And therefore, it can't be right. Which actually is not a bad argument to make. Right? If you hold a view or a belief or a worldview or a philosophy, some sort of faith system, and it doesn't make sense, I would encourage you to carefully examine it, because what we believe ought to make sense. Right? And I think that's an important thing. Even if you have friends or family members who maybe hold beliefs that you know just sort of don't make sense, don't do it in a mocking, belittling way. But it's certainly, I think, a good thing to come to them and in a kind, gracious way, help them consider whether what they believe actually makes sense. Right? There's all sorts of worldviews that people just have bought into without fully considering them. I mean, evolution is a perfect example of a worldview, of a belief system that actually examined makes no sense, but most people haven't examined it. But you examine that and try to live it out consistently, and all of a sudden you see this belief system, it makes no sense. Now, Eliphaz has come to Job, and that's his point. To Job, what you believe makes no sense. The problem is Eliphaz has not had the privilege of seeing chapter 1 and 2 like we have. Eliphaz does not have the full scene. He can't get to the point of being able to actually examine what's going on. He just has his system that he has bought in hook, line, and sinker. And according to the system, what Job's saying makes no sense. Eliphaz hasn't even begun to dream that the system might not be right. So that's the first point he wants to make. Job, what you said makes no sense, therefore must be wrong. The second word, or second point in verse 4, is essentially this. Job, what you're saying is actually dangerous. It's very dangerous because here's what happens, Job. If you consistently hold to what you are claiming, that the outcome of your life and the actions of your life are not necessarily related. In other words, you are not suffering because you're bad, or you're not blessed because you're good. If those things don't connect, if there's no moral order to the world, then Job, this is very dangerous, because now all of a sudden, people won't be able to relate to God based on the system. And Job, that's a dangerous thing. Now, Eliphaz puts it this way. You're doing away with the fear of God. That's the Old Testament way of describing how people have a relationship to God, that we're to fear God, that that's sort of the basis of it. And Eliphaz is saying, Job, everything you've said and claimed undermines it, cuts out the bank from under how we know how to relate to God. And so it's dangerous. Ultimately, Job, you will hinder people meditating on God. That's somewhat ironic because over in James chapter 5, verse 11, a verse I pointed out to you a couple months ago, James is actually held up as an example for us. Eliphaz is saying, Job, you're a bad example. The New Testament is saying Job's a good example of what? Of patience, which is just trust that waits, right? Isn't that all patience is? It's just trust that just says, I'll just keep waiting and hoping. That's what patience is. The New Testament says that's what Job does. But Eliphaz, all he can see is the danger in what Job keeps pointing out. And I guess there's even something to be learned a little bit there. There are some dangerous things in life. There's dangerous things when it comes to some of the truths we hold, things that we ought to be very careful about. I'd point one of them out, especially if you had kids that just went off to kids' church. I think one of the dangers for us is that in teaching our kids to be good, to do what's good, and to not do what's bad, which I hope is what we're doing as parents, it's what we ought to be doing, the danger is we could raise moral kids who have no trust in the gospel. They might be good, they just might not be saved. And I think there's something that's really important for us who have been a part of the church and raised our families in the church to make sure that we help our kids also understand that as much as we want them to be good and not bad, ultimately none of us are good enough to stand before a holy God. Yes, we pursue what's right. Yes, we do what's right. Yes, we try to make wise choices, but we understand that we will always fall short and we need the gospel. So we need to be gospel-proclaiming parents. So our kids never lose sight of that piece. The third thing Eliphaz points out to Job in verse 5 and 6 is that ultimately Job's whole point, his words, are all self-serving. Eliphaz is basically saying, Job, the only reason you now have rejected the system that we all understand to be right and true is because you're suffering. It points out that you must be sinful, and now you've come up with a new way of thinking or a new understanding of the world that is entirely self-serving. That's it. You didn't arrive at this because it just seemed right and true. You arrived at this because you're trying to get yourself off the hook. Fourthly, from verse 7 to 10, Job, everything you've said is arrogant. Just listen to the description. Are you the first man who was born? This is the words of the comforter. Job, we're here to comfort. Job, do you think you're the first person on this planet? Do you think you're older than the hills, like older than dirt? Job, do you think you're superior to us? Have you actually been in the counsel of God, Job? Which, of course, is ironic. Had they been in the counsel of God, they would have known that actually Job was right all along. Do you limit wisdom to yourself? Job, do you think you are the only person on the planet who has wisdom? Don't you understand? We have gray hair. Now, isn't this a great verse? I could point to myself. That's where he gets to in verse 10. We have the gray-haired and the aged among us. We are older than your dad, Job. Should be listening to anyone. It should be us. We understand the world. Job, you're wrong. You are simply arrogant. Lastly, from verse 11 to verse 13, sort of an interesting final point he's going to make. Are the comforts of God too small? The word that deals gently with you basically comes out this way in English. Job, we've come and we arrived here to comfort you. And we think we have done a pretty good job. And frankly, Job, we're offended that you don't agree with us. We're offended that you actually aren't coming and telling us how great a job we have done comforting you. Instead, everything out of your mouth seems to challenge that. We are troubled that you are troubled that we haven't done a better job. So we're offended, Job. We're hurt. It's quite a petty sort of point he's driving at in that last little section there. But that's essentially what it boils down to. We did our best. We explained the system the best we could, the most gentle way possible. And Job, you haven't even shown one trace of thanks for everything we've done for you. And so he concludes the way he does there in the final couple of verses. You are corrupt. You are an abomination. Now, that's the first part of chapter 15. And actually, if you like kind of making notes in your Bible, I've drawn a line between verse 16 and verse 17. Because it seems like for the first 16 questions, first 16 verses, he asks this series of questions to drive home his point that, Job, you're still wrong. We're still convinced you're wrong. And then from verse 17 to the end, he does what I would understand to be what we in school, we called them character sketches. It seemed like in the first service, about half the service went to a school like me. And the other half stared sort of at me blankly. I remember going to school, and we used to do these things where we would, like, draw a picture. So, okay, in your mind's eye, draw a hero on the page, okay? So you got a page, blank page, you draw your hero, cape, whatever else you want there, and then label it. Label it with the virtues. Did anyone go to school and do this? A few of you. Yeah, all right, there's a couple of us. All right, so then you label it with the virtues. Courageous, strong, able to fly over big buildings, like hero-type virtues. Or draw a villain, and then label the villain with villainous type traits. Okay, you're tracking what sort of kind of school I went to? Eliphaz seems to do this, and he says, I'm going to draw a character sketch of a wicked man. I'm going to draw a picture for you from verse 17 to the end of the chapter of what a wicked man looks like. And I'm going to list the character traits. I'm going to describe how they function, of what they do. Of not just how they function and what they do, what their life looks like, but I'm going to actually go even further than that. I'm going to start talking about the things they fear. And then I'm going to even push further than that. I'm going to talk about the outcome of their life. What happens to a wicked man? And through the rest of those verses, that's what he does. He just pushes through this picture. And he tells us that this is all not just based on his idea. If you look in verse 17, 18, 19. Let me just read it. I will show you, hear me. And what I have seen, I will declare, what wise men have told without hiding it from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no stranger passed among them. You're going, what is he talking about? He's essentially saying, I'm going to tell you what is true, what wisdom tells us to be true, back before there was any outsiders to come along to mess this up. That's the picture. So we've got a land. We have no strangers who have come into it. So we've got a pure understanding of what's right and wise and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. So this is before anything gets confused and messed up by anyone coming in with wrong thinking to mess us up. I will tell you what a wicked man is like, Job. And then he starts telling us what a wicked man looks like. He goes through the whole thing. And I think his point is to get to the end and say, and Job, if you look carefully at yourself in a mirror, you know who you're going to see, Job? You're going to see you. In all the descriptions of what I've just written. I mean, I could point out a couple if you want to just get a sense of it. If you look, verse 28. He's lived in desolate cities and houses that none should inhabit, which were ready to become heaps of ruin. Job, what does your house look like right now? See what he's getting at? Saying, Job, I'm going to describe for you what a wicked person's life looks like and what their fate and outcome of their life is. And Job, if you listen carefully, you will hear me describe you. So you see, Job, the system is absolutely 100% accurate. You suffer because you're wicked. That's Eliphaz's comforting speech, part two. Now, Job's going to respond for the next two chapters. He'll respond again partly to his friends and partly to God. And I think he's going to drive home lots of points. But I want to point out five things that I see as I wade through Job's response that I think, well, for me have become the real applicable parts. First one, actually, before we jump in into his response here. When grace is denied or rejected, it seems to me that people become brutal. So I'm not surprised by Eliphaz at this point. Because I think he's decided that grace cannot be a part of how he understands the world to function. The system doesn't have a lot of room for grace. There's a little bit. I'll get to that in a moment. It doesn't have a lot of room for grace. And where there's no grace, people start acting very brutally. I've seen it more than enough to know that it's true. And if all that's true, then here's what I think the take-home for us is, that we need to work hard to live out grace all the time. Okay, now here's where grace does fit in the system. You see, the system doesn't mind grace as long as it stays in its right box, as long as, in our eyes, it's deserved. You see how that works? If you've done good, you get good. If you've done bad, you get bad. The system doesn't mind grace for those who have earned it. But if it's not earned, it's not given. And all of a sudden, you start to realize how contrary to the nature of God that is, because none of us have earned grace. Isn't that the sort of the basic heart of the gospel message? It is completely undeserved, unearned. That's the point. If it wasn't for grace, we'd be without hope because we can't earn it. We need a God who's full of grace and compassion, or we are without hope. That's the whole point of the gospel. That's why the system can't be. But I don't know about you, but I am a terrible, terrible judge of who is deserving of grace. Just imagine a scene for a minute. You're driving in your car and someone cuts you off. I'll tell you what goes through my head. Actually, no, maybe I won't. I don't. There's no cursing or anything like that. But it's never a good. I never assume they've done it for a good reason. I guess that's the point. I always assume there's some sort of bad thing to do. They're arrogant. What gives them the right? Who do they think they are that they're more important than me, that they need to cut in front of me? Never once do I think maybe they're distracted because they were just at a doctor's and got news that has just blown up their world. Never once do I think maybe they just came away from work and the last thing they got on the way out was the pink slip and they were told, don't come back next week. You see, my mind doesn't go there. My mind goes the opposite direction. My mind goes to suspicion and mistrust, right? And then I don't show grace because I don't think it's earned. Because that's how I apply the system. I hope you do it differently. But I suspect you're more like me than not, which is why we need to live out grace constantly. Because we don't have the ability to figure out when it's earned and when it's deserved, do we? We should then, therefore, just always show it. Because would it not be much better to misapply grace sometimes than to mess that up? To find someone at a moment of profound need and us not show grace. That's the first thing I walk away with in reading Job's story before I even get to his response. Would it not have been so much better for the friends to have shown up and said, Job, we don't understand what's going on. We thought this is how the system works. It seems like this must be how the world works. And Job, we see what's happening in your life. And according to the system we've always believed in, here's the conclusion we seem to come to. But Job, instead we're just going to show you grace. We just don't know what else to do. Wouldn't that have been such a radically different book? But you see, they just get stuck in the system. Now, important point on the system, every religion is about the system. Every one of them. Oh, the rules are different. The wording, the list, the description, it's all different. Which is why, if you're like me, you find yourself at a point where you're talking to people who aren't familiar with Christianity, and if you're not a Christian yet, please hear this very carefully. Constantly struggling for words to somehow articulate that Christianity is different. Have you ever found yourself saying, I don't think Christianity is a religion, I think of it as a relationship? See, I think that's an attempt we make to try to make sure that people understand we're not saying that the world is all about the system and that's who God is. We're saying God is somehow fundamentally different. He is a God of grace, not a God of a system. But in every generation, there's a new system. There's new champions of the system. Just go read the Gospels. You'll find out their names at that point were the Pharisees. Jesus, this is just how it works. So we actually think it's better that one man dies so that we can preserve the system. Probably worth us asking ourselves, who's advocating the system in our day, and make sure we're not on that team, right? We want to be on the gospel grace side of things. All right, so Job starts responding. Let's get into the heart of it. He answers in verse 1 and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall windy words have an end, or what provokes you that you answer. I also could speak as you do. If you were in my place, I could join words together against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips would assuage your pain. In other words, Job says, if the roles were reversed, I could do exactly what you've just done to me. You are terrible comforters. You're not doing a very good job at all. Now, there's a play on words there through those couple. Basically, he starts using the word trouble. He uses it multiple times. He said, I was having all these troubles, and you came along and troubled me, and now I have even more trouble. That's kind of what he's just said. How's that for irony? You're supposed to comfort me, but you've actually just caused more trouble. You're miserable troublemakers. And then Job starts wrestling back with God, which leads me, I guess, to the next two points I think are important for us to make sure we understand. Point number two. Life is all about God and the pursuit of God. And Job just brings this wonderful clarity for me when I read his story. Again, it keeps coming back to this whole thing of the friends of Job, the comforters. He keeps saying, Job, just repent, just acknowledge you're wicked, and you're going to get your stuff back. Houses, land, crops, animals, you'll get it all, houses. And Job keeps stubbornly saying, it's not about that stuff. It has got to be about God. Tell me how I make sure I'm in a right relationship with God. All the time, he keeps sort of setting the conversation with the friends aside and starts having a conversation with God as he tries to work out, what is going on? How do I make sense of this? Because it appears that God is doing all this to me, that he is the source of my suffering and pain. Look at how he starts talking in verse 11. God gives me up to the ungodly and casts me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease and he broke me apart. He seized me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. He set me up as his target. He says it's like God has got a bow and arrow and I'm the target. Job doesn't see from chapter 1 and 2 that it's not actually the direct hand of God. That there's a hand of Satan involved in this. Yes, God is sovereign, but Job doesn't see the rest of the story. But he does see this much clearly, that the pursuit of God is fundamentally the most important thing, period. That's important. You lose sight of that when you start pursuing other stuff. You're going to find yourself shipwrecked. Do you ever hear those stories? I know you have, where you hear some rich, famous musician or actor who ends up tragically taking their life, and I'm not meaning to take light of that at all for a second. But what goes through your mind when you hear those stories reported? I'll tell you what goes through my head. It's like, how could someone who has it all arrive at that point? You see, that's precisely the point that Job is driving us at. They didn't have it all. They actually were missing the one most important thing, which isn't that so clarifying? Because most of us will never have it all. We could easily get confused into thinking that if I had it all, and so we make our lives a pursuit of getting all the stuff, never fully getting there, thinking that if I could just get a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, eventually I will get at a point where I'll have enough and then I will be satisfied. And Job helps us to understand he's had it all. And when he lost it all, he says, I don't need all the stuff back. I just need God. Which leads to the third point. Job is going to continue to trust even in the fog, even when he can't see. It's an amazing thing. Actually, Job is not so much a book, right? We've talked about this. It's not so much a book that answers the problem of suffering or evil in life, in the world. It's more a book that's about faith. Faith that just will not let go, even when it's in the fog. And maybe actually that's actually the nature of faith itself. Doesn't faith suggest we don't always see or don't always understand? Isn't that what faith means, that we trust when we don't have all the reasons and all the propositional statements worked out? We just are going to hang on to God no matter what. That's Job. He's going to hang on no matter what. He starts working this out. You can read as he starts trying to put the pieces together of this as he wrestles with who God is and what's going on in his life. By verse 16, my face is red with weeping. On my eyelids is deep darkness. Although there's no violence in my hand and my prayer is pure. O earth, cover not my blood and let not my crying find, or sorry, let my crying find no resting place. It's kind of like that story of Cain and Abel, where he's suggesting, you know, the suffering I've gone through, it has to be dealt with. There has to be some sort of explanation to this. Even now, verse 19, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. My friends scorn me. My eye pours out my tears to God. And then listen to this. Listen to how Job just is going to stubbornly cling to a hope and faith in God, that he would argue the case of a man with God. It's a brilliant statement. My eyes pour out tears to God, that he would argue the case of a man with God. Job, what are you imagining? Like, what are you picturing, Job? You're picturing yourself suffering at the hand of God, hoping that God would come to your defense against himself. Isn't that incredible? It's a guy who didn't get to live to see Jesus. He doesn't get to hear the story that God is going to send his one and only son, who is fully God, who actually do exactly what he just described. He will just hold to this faith that his only hope could be God for him against God. At a time when no one had all the pieces to put together. That is massive faith. That's what Job has. Massive, massive faith. Fourthly, Job will look through the eyes of his heart. And by heart, I don't mean, don't take me to mean like feelings and emotions. I mean faith. And there's three options Job could have had. Number one, he could have looked through the eyes of the system. All right, so kind of picture it like a pair of glasses, right? Have you ever, I don't know, those 3D ones don't quite do it, but put on a pair of glasses that just sort of shapes the way. You're all very blurry right now, by the way. There you go. Now you're clear. All right, imagine if the system were a pair of glasses. You put the system on and it shaped how you view the world. That's what the friends have done. They have a system. They put it on. The world is perfectly clear to them. It's perfectly clear to them that Job is 100% wrong. And they never get around to saying it, but they think it. They're 100% right. They're not suffering. Right? And when they wear the glasses of the system, that just the world just makes sense. The other option is to look through the eyes of your head, just circumstance. Job had that option. He could have looked around and gone, I'm suffering. This is terrible. We could come up with all sorts of other options to explain that. God doesn't exist, or there's many gods, and they're like battling it out. There's good gods and bad gods. There's people on this planet who believe that. He could have come up with all sorts of different options. He doesn't go that route. Instead, he hangs on to this final route. Well, he will continue to look through the eyes of faith, where he'll just say, I know my Redeemer lives. Oh, I just know it. Right? You hear those statements that keep popping up in Job in the middle of hopelessness. I just know that there is a mediator who will come to my defense. I know that even though my flesh is going to be destroyed, with my eyes, I'm going to see God. That's looking through the eyes of the heart, because there is nothing in his circumstance that would have led him to believe that. Are you looking through the eyes of faith? I hope you are. Because if you ever slip into looking through the eyes of circumstance, it's going to lead you astray. Job teaches us to just continue to look through the eyes of faith. Lastly, it's always bad when a preacher takes a week off because he comes back with way too much. I had many hours on a plane yesterday going over my notes. Fifth, and this is going to sound weird because Jesus doesn't show up in the story, but I'll get there. Trust Jesus as Lord and Savior because he's our hope. That's what I walk away with from this little part of Job. I get it from the last half of chapter 17. He starts out in chapter 17 saying this, my spirit is broken, my days are extinct, the graveyard's ready for me. That's hopelessness. That's a man who's pretty much given up. And yet he continues to wrestle. He doesn't just put the pen down. He doesn't just say, therefore, I'm not going to say anything else. It's just this stubborn thing that just keeps holding on. By the end of the chapter, he starts talking about hope. He talks about it multiple times. He starts talking about verse 15. Where then is my hope? Who will see hope? How do we find hope? It's this question that Job won't let go of. Like, that's the thing that counts. By the time you get to the end of the book, you find out God's answer to that. That his answer is going to be God contending against himself, doing exactly what Job described. God there on behalf of people just like us, because he's holy and we are deserving of his wrath. And so God sends his only son to take that wrath upon himself.